So tonight's talk is going to be the third in a series and following this idea of markers on a mountain path. And if you follow the right markers, you head in the right direction. And if you misread them or don't see them, you go in the wrong direction. There's four markers that I would like to talk about tonight. But I'd like to start, and it illustrates one of the markers with an experience that I had. And I'm not sure how long ago this is now, because I keep having in my mind that this isn't that long ago, but I think it must be 7 or 8 years, because it was right at the time that the St. John's Center for Homeless Women and Children had just built their new center. So I think it's that long again. Go. Not that long?
No.
5 years?
Yeah, maybe.
5 years, okay. So the director, they hadn't opened it yet. They were just in the final stages of it. And the director had contacted me and asked if I would be willing to do some meditation classes for the women. And this particular place, if you stay at it, when they opened it was really beautiful for the community. And the requirement was is that you had to do so many units of courses and to look for housing and a whole series of preconditions to be able to have this housing. And if you didn't honor that, they'd kick you out, which they would. They would do it, you know. But they hadn't opened this up yet, and so I asked if I could go over and look at the housing. And the housing was over where the Mustard Seed School is and the soup kitchen and that whole area. And she took me over there one night and took me upstairs in one of their buildings and took me into a room that, well, it's bigger than this room. But not an awful lot bigger, but it was absolutely filled, every single inch of it, with just kind of homemade bunk beds, you know, that they had slapped together. And the space between the bunk beds, you had to turn your body sideways to walk down that, and they had the entire room filled. And the ceilings on the room were quite low, so that the person who was on the top one, you know, didn't have much space. And I'm sure it violated every fire code provision and everything. And my reaction to it, for me, it was heartbreaking. It was just horrendous to think that you had women with relatively small children living in those conditions. It was better than being on the street, but it was really miserable. So, I don't know, it took 6-8 months. They had opened up the center, went over, did a few things at the center, and then we worked it out where they would bus the women over to the Friends Meeting House, and they would spend the entire morning there. So I think we'd start at 8:30, and we'd go from like 8:30 to 12, and lunch was at 12:15, 12:30, and so the bus would have to be there at a certain time and to get them back for lunch. Okay. So, I'd never worked with this population before, and candidly, I was kind of anxious. You know, I was the wrong gender, the wrong color, the wrong class, the wrong everything in my mind, So I was kind of nervous about this. And when the women first came there, the first thing that was noticeable was, you know, how we walk in and we leave all of our shoes out in the front, and that's what we do at the Friends. They would come in, and they refused to take their shoes off, much less leave them where they couldn't see them. Okay. So we came in, we were in a circle, and the first two sessions, I couldn't even convince them to take their shoes off. And they had little purses that the center had given them that were like you see in Israel, you know, that are completely clear. So like a lot of the women in Israel will have these purses that you can see through. So even to go into a department store, you have security. So you can see right through it. And so there, they want to make sure that, you know, there's no firearms and nothing, no lighters and no drugs. So, you know, I wanted them to, like, they would put the purses in their lap. And they didn't even want to put the purses down next to them and let go of them. And so a number of the women took the purses, took their shoes off, put the handle of the purses up around their ankle, and then put the shoe back on. You know. So they were very... everybody kind of had an attitude because they thought that this was mandatory, despite the fact that my position was is that it wouldn't be mandatory. They got credit if they came, but they thought because they were getting credit, it was mandatory. You know, so we kind of went through this whole thing. And initially, you know, they were they weren't like this crowd. You know, a lot of crosstalk, pretty loud. You know, it was really clear that group support was everything for them. You know. Don't have much, but you do. You do have the group support, you know. And they kind of get in my face when I say stuff if they didn't agree with it, challenge me. So it was really fascinating, you know. And so over a period of like 8 weeks, it was. This is one of the most satisfying experiences that I've had, you know, as a teacher. And over a period of about 8 weeks. They began to realize that, you know, they would say, we're just sick of people treating us like we're homeless people. And we're sick of people helping us. You know? And so at some point they got it that I had absolutely no agenda other than to, like, offer them, you know, what we do. And I wasn't going to demand anything of them. And it became really clear that all of them were... yeah, just so brutal their situation that they were all exhausted and had cumulative stress. And what they really needed was just to rest. That's what they really needed, just to rest. So I completely changed my objective and tried to figure out ways that, you know, very, very modest objectives, work with the breath a little bit. We'd always end with a body scan on the floor, which they loved because every one of them would fall asleep. Mm-hmm. I got them to the point where they could do that. They were trusting enough. And the walking meditation, because I figured that the breathing and the walking would be the two things that they could take with them. You know? So I don't know. I did, I think, 4 8-week of those sessions. And every one of them, by the end, the women would say the same thing. They'd say, this is really great because this is the only place that we can go where we feel completely safe. You know? So it felt just a huge accomplishment. So, and so here's the part of the story to lead into the marker. There was one woman in the second or third session, her name was Maxine, and she's kind of a big woman, you know, and big hair, you know, and big voice, and, you know, kind of undisciplined. You know, she had kind of an undisciplined look to her, and so we started doing all these exercises, and then, you know, I noticed that it seemed like she was, like, really taking this seriously. So one morning when we were walking out in the back of the Friends, where they have the little grass, I noticed that there were a couple of women out there talking. So she went over there and just read them the riot act. I mean, she just dressed them down and said, hey, you know, we're supposed to be quiet out here doing walking meditation, and you know, you're interrupting my walking meditation, and you know, knock it off. You know? So I thought, wow, like, she's serious about this, you know? And then she really started working at it. And she would stay awake during the body scans. You know, she got to the point where she could do that. And she could do sitting meditation. And so if you do anything like this, you know, particularly like this where they're away from the center, you find out how important food is to a homeless person. And so this bus was supposed to be there at a particular time, and it was calculated to get them back so they could have their lunch meal. And one day the bus doesn't show up on time, and then like it's 5 minutes late and it's 10 minutes late, and these ladies really started getting distressed. So I called the facility, and they said, well, the person who's supposed to drive bus, there was a problem, and we're sending somebody over, and we promise, you know, we'll get there and get them back, and if we're late, we'll save food for. So I come back with that report, which is not well received. You know, I mean, they're really upset, and so we start talking about it, and they're just, you know, they're really upset and kind of talking trash, and I look, and it's like, well, where's Maxine? You know. So somebody says, well, she's over in the corner. So I look over, and this Maxine is over in the corner. I mean, like, with her face in the corner. So I said, hey, Maxine, what's going on? What are you doing over there? And she goes, I am so pissed off, but I'm breathing. And, you know, I just love that. You know, because she had learned that would save her, you know. And a couple of sessions later, she came back, and she was so proud of herself that she had gone to, she had a real temper, a terrible temper, and she'd gone to a housing interview. And she didn't like the way she was being treated, and she started getting angry, and she said she just, you know, stopped, practiced her breath, and then came back, and she was able to continue the interview without losing her temper, and she got this little housing thing, and she and her kids were able to move there. And after she moved, the director came over and wanted to see what we were doing, you know. And she said the reason she came over was that she couldn't believe the change in Maxine, because Child Protective Services was considering taking her children away from her because her temper was so bad and she would hit the kids. And she said that since she started doing, you know, just this simple little thing, that every time that she would start to get angry, either with one of the other women or with her kids, that she would stop and go off separate someplace and breathe for a while, and then come back, and it had really changed her behavior, you know. So that, for me, that was like big deal, you know. And it illustrated for me that somebody who had really taken this and owned it completely and integrated it into their life in some way, you know, I think sometimes so many people, like in our community, who are basically educated people to some degree, and it actually gets in the way. And with her, you know, she was so raw that she was looking for a lifeline, and she had found the lifeline and was going to use it, you know. So there is a sutta in which you may know that all of the suttas in the Pali Canon aren't by the Buddha, historical Buddha. They're by a number of other senior disciplines. So Sariputta was one of them. But, on this tanka on the left, where there's the two figures down at the bottom, there's Sariputta and Mahamoggallanda. And they were kind of like the CEO and CFO of the Sangha. You know, they had kind of oversight responsibilities administratively. And so there's a sutta by Sari Putta called the Sutta or Discourse on No Blemishes. And in that, basically, what he does is talks about having a bronze bowl, or a really beautiful bronze bowl, and that if you take that and put it in a dusty place and pay no attention to it, in relatively short order, it won't be a beautiful bronze bowl anymore. It'll be tarnished and dusty. But if you take that bowl and care for it and clean it and polish it, it will be this beautiful thing. And the analogy is that Sariputta is making is that if we do that with our mind and our body and our relationships using the four foundations and the Brahma Viharas, that that our life will be like that. It will be like a bright, shining, beautiful bronze bowl that radiates out its energy to other people, to animals, to the natural world. So there are several things I'd like to talk about for a while tonight, and they're similar to the talk the other night. On the surface, they seem like they're so obvious that it's like, well, we know that. But they are obvious, but they are so profound if we actually adopted them, that they're potentially transformative. And they're difficult. So the first one relates to Maxine, and it has to do with the role of integration. And not integration in the sense that we've been talking about it, where we're integrating insight practice and the Brahma Viharas, you know, an integrated path. It's integration in the sense of taking this integrated path we've been trying to work with and integrate it into your life. And I'm sure all of us have had the experience of we come on retreat and you know, we do all this work, and we feel like we're making some real progress, and then we go back to our daily life and quite quickly fall back into all of our old habits. Okay. So this talk isn't about what to do to deal with that. That's tomorrow night when the three of us are going to talk. But what it is about the idea that something is missing if we aren't doing like what Maxine was doing. That we need to figure out how to create a direct line between an integrated path of practice that we're working on right into the middle of our regular life. So that integrated path of practice informs all of our life. I think this is the key. Okay. So another story to illustrate this point. Myself and actually a number of people here went to India on a pilgrimage the year before last, and we were gone there for like 3.5 weeks, and we had this driver on the bus who we thought was just a bus driver. It was a really nice bus, a great big comfortable bus. It was air conditioned. It was really terrific. And so he came to Bodh Gaya, picked us up in Bodh Gaya after we'd been there a number of days, and then we started off on the trip, and we went to Vulture's Peak, you know, the famous Vulture's Peak, where so many things happened. And then we first stop after Bodh Gaya was Rajgir, which is where the bamboo grove is, and that was the first dedicated piece of property given to the Sangha. So we all thought that he was just a bus driver. And so we get to Rajgir and go to this hotel, a little hotel called the Siddharth Hotel. And the routine is that you get to the hotel, you go in, and Have two people check everybody in, and we got passport numbers and copies of passports and all of this, so everybody doesn't have to do it. And so the owner there, who is kind of this traditional Indian man, kind of wanted us to agree on what the menu was going to be for the couple of days that we were going to be there, and presents us with this menu. And it's kind of like, you know, the first time you go into a Vietnamese restaurant that you've never been in before, and you know, it's like, I don't know, 27 pages of items, and they're all in Hindi, right? So, you know, I'm kind of sitting there, and he's trying to explain to me, you know, different dishes, and then all of a sudden, Sean, the driver, is just like right here, and he's like, well, he says, you know, this dish right here, he's kind of like almost whispering, you know, he says, you know, this dish right here, I think everybody would really like that, you know. And he describes to me what it was, and then this dish here, and he was right, you know. And we subsequently learned he had done something like 12 of these pilgrimages before, so you know he kind of knew what the Western taste. So with him, we were able to create this really nice menu, and the food was very good there. And then, you know, a number of people went out. There is a little public market there. And at the far side of the public market, you know, there's an area that's not too good. You know, we wouldn't want pilgrims to go down there. So people came back, and several of the women said, well, you know, we were in the market, you know, and just out of nowhere, Sean was there, and he was saying, hey, you know, I think you should go look at the stuff over here, you know, like not down there, what have you. And, you know, he doesn't say that's the bad area, don't go down there. You know, he just kind of like he's hurting, you know, he just like hurts people back. And then a couple of the guys were negotiating to buy, I don't know what they were buying at one of the booths. I don't know if they were buying malas or what. But, you know, they're talking to this guy and they're getting ready to pay him. And then all of a sudden, Shyam's there over their shoulder, and he's kind of whispering, how much do we want to charge you, you know? And he goes, no, don't pay that, don't pay that, you know? And then he starts negotiating with the guy, and, like, you know, they get it for about half of what they were going to pay him. And then as the trip went on, this guy, I wish Jerry was here, because Jerry would start, Jerry had a couple of experiences with him. This guy just turned out to be this extraordinarily kind and caring person, and he was really the embodiment of metta. He was so thoughtful, and there were just repeated illustrations of him seemingly out of nowhere showing up and extending himself. And one of the members of the group got very, very sick. They actually had malaria. And we stayed over in Srivasti a couple of extra days because we didn't think that we could transport him. And so we were giving him sponge baths all night, because when you have that, you get really hot. And I don't know, 10:30 at night, you know, and what the way it works is there's on the bus there's a lead man and a second man, and they sleep in the bus, and they cook their own food and stay there, you know. So 10:30 at night, there's a knock on the door, and it's him. And he's got a bunch of fruit juices and things, and he comes in, and he says, I thought, you know, this might help. And then, you know, before we know what's going on, he's giving our friend a massage, you know. So just over and over and over, I mean, it was really extraordinary. So he and I kind of got to be buddies, and we had all this kind of like sign language that we would do, you know, because there's a big glass barrier between the drivers and the back. He started calling me Daddy, you know, which is a sign of affection, you know, there. So at one point, everybody gets off the bus, and he and I are just sitting there, you know, just kind of rapping as well we can, you know, broken English and no broken Hindi. And I said to him, there was something hanging, you know, it was one of those buses with this great big huge window, wraparound window, you know, it had a big rearview mirror, and there was something hanging from it, and I knew it was a Hindu god, but I didn't know what it was, you know. So I said to him, hey, you know, what is that? And, you know, the whole time he was very affectionate towards me and very respectful, and several times he and I, you know, went off by ourselves into town together, and you know, it was really a great relationship. And this is the only time where he just kind of looked at me like that's a really stupid question, you know. And he said, well that's Hanuman. And I think we mentioned Hanuman the other night, you know, it's a Hindu god, and it's half Muti, half man, and it's, among other things, depending on the context, it means many things, but it's a god of service. And, you know, and all of these pantheon of gods that they have in Hinduism, you know, are really embodiments of the power within you. You know, they're not exterior gods. And so I said, well, why do you have Hanuman on your window? On the rearview mirror? And he said, well, I have Hanuman there to protect me so I can protect you. So he can protect me, so I can protect you. So for me, it was just like, I don't know, it was like really a defining moment to explain the kindness and the care and everything with this guy, that all of these things that we had been seeing were a direct manifestation of his spiritual life, you know. And it was so clear, it was just so direct, you know, there was nothing intellectual about it. We didn't have to think about it, you know, it was right there. And so I think this is an extraordinary thing, to be able to have this in your life this way. And I think this is like, of the markers I'm going to talk about, I think this is the first one. And I think it's a provocative one, because I'm sure we've all now know a lot of people in different Buddhist communities, and I've been around them, and honestly speaking, this kind of like very clear direct connection, I don't see that often. I see something that's much more casual, that doesn't involve the deep commitment that would be required to actually make the Dharma or your spiritual practice the actual center of your life, that would inform everything else. So I'm putting that out, as I think this is something that really deserves thoughtful reflection, and to the degree that we could do this, even to a small degree, it would reshape our thinking and our conduct and our relationships significantly. I mean, just putting it in the middle, even if it took years to start to like actually have it spread out into every part of our life, if it was like 10% or 15% or 20%, I think it would be a radical transformation in how we would relate to our life and what we would do. So that's one. The second one relates to the topic that Rich has been introducing us to and working with us, and it relates to equanimity. And for me, you hear this in the phrases, but where we're, part of this is we're trying to develop not only a balance, but some of those phrases very clearly are designed to begin to develop acceptance. Some of them, it's not so clear. But the second marker would be the role of acceptance. And by that I mean the complete acceptance of the circumstances of your life. So, you know, during all of the many interviews that we've done so far, there's a series of themes that emerge, you know, and so people are reflecting on that someone hurt them, or they hurt someone, or they did something that they wish they could take back, or that they failed to do something that they wish that they could have done, that they wanted to or still want to have a relationship with someone that it's impossible to have a relationship with anymore, that there are problems with the outer circumstances of their life, you know, whether it's relationships or jobs or whatever it may be, and then all the complaints about our internal life. You know, we're dissatisfied with, or anxious, or we're depressive, or we feel inadequate, or have low self-esteem, or, you know, the list just goes on, right? I mean, it's like, gee, the human condition, okay? And in all of those reports, it seems to me that one of the predominant things that jumps out is that they're of course, all reported with a significant degree of resistance. Like, we don't want the these things in our lives, which is a healthy motivator. And having said that, to the degree that we do not fully accept that those are the conditions of our life, that prevents us from making a certain kind of progress. And I'm not using acceptance in the sense that, well, that's going to be the rest of my life. But it's like, no, like, right now, this minute, that is the condition of my life, and I have a choice of either to be in resistance against it and trying to change, or I'm going to embrace it and try to change. And those are two profoundly different postures in relationship to difficulties in our life. So, one of my all-time favorite people is Joseph Campbell, you know, who was a mythologist and the president of the World College of Religions, and, you know, wrote so many wonderful books. And this is one of my favorite quotations from him, and it's about this topic. He says, "The first step to the experience of the wonder and the mystery of life is the recognition of its monstrous nature, of the earthly human realm, as well as its glory. The realization that this is just how it is and that it cannot and will not be changed. So if you really want to help in this world, what you will have to teach is how to actually live in it. And that no one can do who has not themselves learned how to live in the joyful sorrow and the sorrowful joy of life exactly as it is. And that no one can do who has not themselves learned how to live in the joyful sorrow and the sorrowful joy of life as it is." So this is really talking about a profound kind of acceptance. This isn't an intellectual acceptance at all. This is the kind of thing that we're doing in our practice. It's intuitive, it's pre-verbal, it's deep, and it's really important. Because if we can do this, the minute that we do it, at the moment, or at some deep level you do that, it's exactly at the same moment that there is a shift, an opening to possibilities of dealing with it that the moment before didn't exist. Because the resistance against it is blocking that. And if it's true that this is our one chance on this particular planet, in this particular form, in this particular consciousness, the difference between opening that door and keeping it closed as part of our process of trying to transform is awfully big. And I have this mantra that I now use, and every time that I see myself turning away from some part of my life that I don't like, I stop, and I don't know why, but it seems like most of the time when I see this, I'm walking. I don't know. There's some kinetic element to it. I don't know what it's about. But I'll stop, and the mantra is, this is my life. You know, I'm not going to turn away from my life. Most of the time I can do it. I can't do it all the time. But for me, that's kind of an honoring of this idea of like how profound it is. Like we keep turning away and we think, well, we're just turning away from aversion or just turning away from anxiety or something. That's not what we're turning away from. Because the Buddha was very clear that in every moment we're making a decision, either to do something or not to do something, which is a decision, and that has a consequence. So that in every moment we are either reinforcing a movement towards our freedom, towards developing a healthier, skillful, or wholesome habit, or reinforcing a negative one. And so, in some way, deeply reflecting on this and then making a commitment about it seems to me to be an essential part of the spiritual life. The next one is the role of caring about ourselves. And some of us, and I guess the majority of us at some point during this retreat, had the experience that all of us at some point have, and of how hard it is to do some of these practices for ourselves. And this most fundamental idea that this practice is not selfish, you know, that we're trying to transform ourselves and the transformation that we have affects other people, the basics. So, you know, the basic question is do we really want to be free? And you don't have to go to the, do I want ultimate liberation for this to be a profound question? I mean, do I want to be free from all the stuff we've been talking about? I mean, really, honestly. I mean, like, do I honestly, really, truly want to be free of this anxiety that I always have, or this sense of inadequacy, or the depression that I have, or you fill in whatever it is that is, you know, troubling you in your life, and it's probably been troubling you for most of your life. You know, it's that. And like, do I really want to be free from that? Or is what I want to do is just be a little more comfortable? Those are two really different goals, and they produce two really different results. And I think it is an important part of the path that I think most people come into communities like ours, as the Buddha said, because they're suffering. And what they're looking for is refuge, and they're looking for comfort. So I don't want to disparage that in any way. It's terribly, terribly important. And I think there's all kinds of times when we have to have refuge and we have to have comfort. And then there is a point where you begin to see that there may be something more that's possible. And then this question, which is a profound question, starts to come up. Because, I mean, like, if we actually really cared about ourselves, is the answer to the question, yeah, this thing that's been plaguing me, sure, let it plague me until I die. But not by turning and facing it in asking yourself about this and making a deep commitment, that's the answer that we're basically giving. You know, it's like we see very clearly, we come here, see very clearly that there's some element of our life that is disrupting our life, that is preventing us from being whole. Get really clear on it, get very emotional about it, then we go back home and just do the same thing that we were doing 6 months ago. So for me, it brings up how profoundly we actually don't care for ourselves in this culture. We're always putting ourselves first, even in the Dharma community. I mean, there's so many Dharma teachers I know that, you know, I talk to them and, how are you? Oh, I'm so busy, you know, I'm exhausted, I'm running here and I'm running there. And I mean, they're putting themselves last, you know. So, another quotation from Joseph Campbell and then Thomas Merton. And so this is for me what's at risk, okay? Some of you have had some, I mean, really beautiful experiences here. And so for me, what's at risk is not having those beautiful experiences. Not having what may actually be possible for us as human beings on this planet before we die. So Joseph Campbell says this: people say that what we're seeking is a meaning to life. I think what we're seeking is an experience of being alive, so that our life experiences on the purely physical level will have resonance with our innermost being in reality, so that we can actually feel the rapture of being alive. People say that what we're seeking is a meaning to life. I think what we're seeking is an experience of being alive, so that our life experiences on the purely physical level will have resonance with our innermost being in reality, so that we can actually feel the rapture of being alive. And, you know, I think there's a bunch of people here who actually felt some rapture about being alive this last 10 days. So, I want to sign up for this. You know, but this idea that we have this inner life and we have all these principles we've been talking about, all the Brahma Viharas, and we say to ourselves that they're really important, but are they actually going to become an integrated part of our life, so that our physical life and our inner life are resonating in tune with each other and our innermost values are expressing themselves in the outer world? This is a high bar. And it's a beautiful thing. And once again, I think unless we really reflect on this and make a commitment, that probably doesn't happen. So Thomas Merton, that we spoke about the other night, Merton made this trip to Asia in 1968 after being in the Gethsemane Monastery in Kentucky, I think, for 30 years. And by that time, even though he hadn't gone outside of the monastery very much, you know, he was an internationally known figure. He was considered one of the big minds of our generation. You know, he was heavily involved in the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement, even though he was in a cloistered monastery. It was pretty extraordinary. And I guess he was also pretty crotchety because they actually, you know, this is a cloistered monastery, and they actually gave him his own cottage out in the woods. You know, it's like, get that guy out of here. Put him over there, you know, he's going to contaminate all the rest of the monks. I mean, he was a real free thinker, you know, and he went through a lot of challenges. Like if you read some of the material that was published after his life, you know, there were a lot of efforts within the monastery to quiet him. You know, he was disciplined, things were taken away from him, and he just, you know, amazingly, he was committed to staying there. And so, in the last 10 years of his life, he had gotten heavily involved in Buddhist thinking, lots of correspondence with Asian teachers, particularly Tibetans. And then he had this big trip planned. And he said when he left that he was going home in a body that had never visited this place, you know. And then he went through this kind of whirlwind of meetings with the Dalai Lama and many other teachers. So he ends up in a Ceylon, and he has this experience. And this is a little longer quotation, but I want to read it because, you know, talking about what's at stake. You know, like, what is it that we're going to do with this practice? This is what I think is possible at varying degrees. You know, it happens in stages, but what's possible. So he's talking about being in this one location in Ceylon. And this, by the way, is out of this book. I can't read it out of the book without my glasses on. So, but it's called The Asian Journal of Thomas Merton, which is really a fascinating read. And the pictures of these statues are here, and they're unique. They're the only place in the world where they're these mammoth statues, and they have kind of elongated bodies, and some of the faces are elongated. So this is what he's describing. So he says, the path dips down to the Gaul Vihara, a wide, quiet hollow surrounded with trees, a low outcrop of rock with a cave cut in it, and beside the cave, a big seated Buddha on the left. This is carved into the stone. And it's not big, it's huge. A big seated Buddha on the left, a reclining Buddha on the right. You know, the Buddha is dying. And Ananda standing by the head of the reclining Buddha. In the cave, I am able to approach the Buddhas barefoot and undisturb my feet in the grass and wet sand. Then the silence of these extraordinary stone faces, the great smiles, huge and yet subtle, filled with every possibility, state of mind now, filled with every possibility, questioning nothing, knowing everything, rejecting nothing. I was knocked over with a rush of relief and thankfulness at the obvious clarity of these figures, the clarity and fluidity of shape and line, the design of the monumental bodies composed into the rock and the landscape. Looking at these figures, I was suddenly, almost forcibly, jerked out of my habitual vision of things in an inner clearness, a clarity as if exploding from the rocks themselves, became evident and obvious. The evidence of the reclining figure, the smile, the sad face of Ananda standing with arms folded. The thing about all of this is that there is no puzzle, there is no problem, and really no, quote, mystery, close quote, about life. All problems are resolved, and everything is clear, simply because what matters is clear. Now, you know, to someone who's never sat in meditation and had some of our experiences, I think most people read that and have no idea what he's talking about. And he's talking about this profound moment of insight. The rock, all matter, all life, is charged with the possibilities of the Dharma. Everything is emptiness. Everything is compassion. I don't know when in my life, and this is one of the greatest spiritual figures of our generation saying this now, I don't know when in my life I have ever had such a sense of beauty and spiritual validity running together in one aesthetic illumination. Surely, with Mahapali Baram and Pulana Rula, those are these two locations, my Asian pilgrimage has come clear and purified itself. I don't know what else remains, but I have now seen, and I have now pierced through the surface, and I have gone beyond the shadow and the disguise. So I think this is just a beautiful statement of someone having a life-affirming experience. Yeah, and I want to sign up for this, too. So I think however we do it, or however we can do it, if we actually deeply care about ourselves, we want these kinds of integrated experiences in our life. We want our practice and we want our life to lead to something that is opening, that gives us the possibility of being fully human. I think that's what this practice promises. Fully human in every sense of opening to everything, rejecting nothing. But the only way that that could possibly happen is that if we actually do deeply care about ourselves. Because we all know how hard it is to do even a minor change. You know, to build in a half-hour exercise regime into your life, or to change your diet, or whatever it may be. So I think this is another thing to think about, and it's maybe the most profound thing that you could think about. Like, what is it that we truly want, with the exception of James, okay, who's still got a little more time than the rest of us, you know, and maybe the big guy over here. You know, the rest of us, time may be short. You know, we have people in the community who are dying and are sick, you know, and asking, you know, what am I going to do with the amount of time that I have left? At least for me, is no longer a philosophical question. You know, like, am I willing to finish out what time I have here on this planet without at least trying seriously to find out what it might be like, what may be possible to be fully human through this practice? So these questions for me are harder and harder to turn away from. So my belief is that if we don't have this kind of deep caring for ourselves at some level, what we have is a lot of techniques and methods and theories that don't have any ultimate juice to them. That when the going really gets tough, that it's really hard to call on these tools, because we don't have this commitment that is organic. You know, it's not an idea. You know, it's like, I'm really pissed off and I'm still breathing. You know, I mean, that was like an organic thing. She somehow realized that would save her life, save her kids' lives. You know? Okay. The last one is the role of caring for others. And the idea is that I think we need to care about someone or someone's, plural, suffering, about somebody else's suffering, more than we care about our own suffering, if we're going to be fully human. So I want to talk about another experience in India. One of the places that most Western pilgrimages go to is these famous burning ghats in Varanasi. And a ghat simply means a cement wall that goes down into the water. So these pictures that you frequently see of people in the water in India doing puja and what have you, many of those are from Varanasi, which is also called Banaras. And so there is a main burning ghat there where they burn bodies and people who are going through transition, that they claim that that light has been continuously lit and overseen by one family, the same family of Dalit, the untouchables, because the Dalits are the ones that handle bodies for 3,000 years. And they've got 1, 2, 3, 4 rows. This is right on the riverbank, and it's dirt. 4 rows of maybe 5 slots each of where they burn bodies. And then they've got a little place up on the back, which is like a VIP place where they would just burn a single body, you know, somebody who's very, very, very important. And so I'd always wanted to go to those. The first time I was there, I thought it was pretty profound. But the second time I was there, I really made a commitment to myself that, you know, the first foundation of mindfulness is the charnel ground meditations, right, where you go to the charnel grounds and look at decaying bodies. And I made a commitment to myself that I was really going to spend some time at these ghats. So I go over in the day, and then at night we would have a circle, just, you know, and then after everybody would go to bed, I would go to the this one big ghat, and I had made friends with a man there, and I don't really understand what his role was, but I know he had some authority or juice or something, because if you're a Westerner, after a certain time at night, they won't let you to go up near the fire or where near any of the families are. You have to stand back more towards the water. So I would go down there, and these, you know, guys would block me off, and I would just wait for him, and he'd come down and get me and take me up there. And then what he started doing, and you know, I'd spend like 4 hours, 4 or 5 hours there. And he would take and he would introduce me to families and then have me sit with the families. And so, you know, imagine that happening here, right? Like a stranger coming into a funeral and saying, hey, he wants to sit in on the funeral with you, right? It just never happened. So, this ghat, they have to bring the body there within 24 hours or they will not burn the body. So there's all these little buildings, little dilapidated buildings, and what they are is basically little hospices where when people are very near the end of their life, their families will bring them there and just wait for them to die so they can get them down there. And the families boil the bodies, wrap them, and then at night when it's the busiest, they're just lined up. So you'll have like 25 bodies all burning at the same time, and then all waiting for a space. And there's no other light other than the burning of the bodies. So it's like spectacular, you know, at night. And they bring the bodies down, take the outer cloth on. You can tell from the outer cloth what the caste is, in the rank in society, whether it's a male or female or a teenager or a child. Take that off. They put them in the water, which is like the final washing. It's believed that if you're washed in the Ganges, it's a sacred thing. And then they bring the body up, and the Dalits have created a pyre. And they put the body on the pyre, and then all of the male members of the family and some females, but not too many, mostly males, participate in this ceremony. And the oldest male has, whether it's, you know, a brother, the oldest son, shave their head and wears a loincloth. and then they kind of officiate. And so they get the body in place, they put more wood on top of it. The person who has his head shaved circumambulates the body so many times, gets the incense that they're going to use, and you know, the type of incense also based on class, and then lights that. And then periodically, while the body's burning, they'll go and, you know, kind of stoke things. And it takes between 3 and 5 hours for a body to completely burn down, depending on how big it is and the nature of it. So one of these two nights, this gentleman put me down with the family, and the body of their mother was like from here to Alice. So everybody just sitting here, you know, right with the body burning. And, you know, try to put yourself in that situation. It's an extraordinary thing, you know, the human body, and it's starting to burn, and it burns down. And then the thing that was striking for me was that no one was crying. You know, they were talking quietly and watching the body burn, but no one was crying. And the son, who was the one who had his head shaved and was in a loincloth, he's probably in his early 30s, he came over and sat down next to me, and you know, he was like really curious why I wanted to be there, you know. And he didn't speak much English, so we, you know, we really couldn't do too much, but he asked me what I thought of this, and he pointed to his mother burning, you know? And I said to him, well, I think it's really beautiful. And that really, really touched him. So then he just grabbed my hand, and then we just sat there for about an hour, just holding hands, watching his mother. And then the very last act every time is that the body is burned down. Most of the smaller bones disintegrate, but there's still, you know, some bones. But what does not disintegrate is the skull. And so pretty much what happens is everything is gone except for the skull. And then the oldest male has a striker. It's maybe 4.5-5 feet high. And at the appropriate time, walks over and hits the skull and cracks it open. And when it's hit, it just falls apart. So, you know, this young man goes over and hits his mother's skull, opens up. And for the Hindus, that act is the belief that the spirit is finally released. And so that all of the earthly suffering is over. And it's kind of an extraordinary moment because, you know, he goes over, hits that, cracks it open, and you could just see the whole group just relax. And then it was like, okay, let's go home. And everybody got up and hugged each other and left. You know, it's not like, let's pick up the ashes and take them home and put them on the altar. I mean, like, no holding on. It's like, okay, they're gonna take care of the body. The ashes are gonna go into the Ganges. You know, that's a guarantee that our mom will be okay. Everybody leaves. You know, and you know, I saw this repeatedly. And at first, I was perplexed by it, and then what I really got quite clearly is that what was going on is that the release of that person's suffering, their release from suffering in this world, was more important than the suffering of the family who was there. They were there for the transition and the end of this person's suffering. on this round of birth. And so for them, it wasn't like a Western burial. You know, everybody's crying and weeping, and in large part, they're crying and weeping for themselves, for their loss. And I'm sure there's a whole sense of loss, and I'm not sure what happens when they go home or before, but it was just so clear that for this extended period of time, 3 to 5 hours, the people were just right there for what they believe was watching the transition. And for me, having experienced that on multiple occasions was just completely transformative of my understanding about living and dying and what at least my role should be in terms of supporting someone in the dying process, that it is not about me, that it is about their suffering, and that to the degree that I put my suffering above their suffering, that there's an element built in, I think, to our culture of narcissism that is unhealthy. Now, that certainly doesn't mean that when we lose somebody that it is an enormous loss and we shouldn't grieve. I mean, it's absolutely critical. But the idea that you would care so much about someone else's suffering that you would be able to be fully present, for me, has become an ideal. And the closest I can get to it, and I only kind of put these two together later, but when my mother, who I think I was really fortunate in talking with so many people who seem to have had so much trouble with their family and their parents, you know, that I had a mother that from as long as I can remember, any recollection I have, completely loved me and unconditionally supported me and loved me. You know, when we do this metta, I know what that is. I know who that is. It is an extraordinary thing to have that in my life, you know. And she was diagnosed with I forget the name of it, but it's a precursor to leukemia. You know, it's a cell problem. And there's no treatment for it. You know, they can give you blood transfusions and you feel better for a while, but you just slowly die. So she had been given this, and they told us that she had like 5 years to live. And that, you know, she just started kind of slowly dying. And she just got weaker and weaker and more tired, doing less and less. And I made the decision to back out of just about everything I was doing so that I could be with her until she died. You know, whether it took 5 years or 2 years, I was going to be with her, both out of my love and to repay my debt to her. And so I was supposed to be in the first community Dharma Leaders program at Spirit Rock, and that's just when she got the diagnosis. So I withdrew from that. I pretty much withdrew from the Dharma community in town that I was participating in. At that time, I just completely withdrew. And I started spending all this time with her. And it ended up being really lucky because about 6 months later, they had her go in for a transfusion. And the disease had progressed further than they had thought. So they went in to put a stent in her chest, and they went in and, you know, they cut the vein open and they're going to put a stent in, right? So they go in and the veins have, I guess, collapsed to some degree. They can't get the stent in. They basically try to sew her up, and because she has a blood condition, they can't really give her the medication they need because that'll kill her. So she goes into intensive care and basically bleeds to death. They can't do anything for her, you know. So, this is one of the reasons I'm so thankful for this practice, and I believe in it so much, is that my practice at that point was sufficiently strong that I really was able to be there with her, and that her suffering was the single most important thing. And I stayed there with her for 7 days, and it very odd. It's probably the most beautiful 7 days I've had in my life. It was some of the most tender moments with her that I had ever experienced. It was amazing. And all these tools that I was working with allowed me to actually be there for her. You know, like I'd start to get frightened, you know. You know, I knew what to do with that, to stay there with her. So, after coming back from India, you know, these two things linked up for me. Like, how beautiful it is that we actually care for somebody else's suffering more than our own. So this is, I think, another piece of the path, you know, and it's, I think, what the Brahma Viharas are, to allow us to get out of the way of ourselves so that when people need us, really, really need us, we can be there for them fully. Not partially, but we can fully be there for them. So for me, these things I've been talking about tonight, you know, the kind of common theme is about being fully human, you know, being able to be fully present for someone we love when they need us, you know, not get in the way and know how to get out of the way, to actually care deeply enough for ourselves that we're willing to change some of our habits, to not be addicted to comfort in the service of creating something at the center of our life and allowing it to inform our life. And then it's like Sariputta's question, you know, the bronze bowl. You know, it's like, if we actually did some of these things, it is like taking care of, polishing, shining, really caring for this bronze bowl that will radiate out this energy and inform our life and inform our relationships with everything around us. And then if we don't polish the bowl, if we don't polish our heart and our body and our mind with these tools, then something else happens. And the key point for me is that this is all a question of choice. You know, we can talk about techniques and theories and methods and all of those. Those are all things that we use when we make a choice to use them. So this decision about can we and will we be fully human or more fully human, can we be and will we care for ourselves deeply? Can we and will we be there for the people that we really love the most when they need us and actually be there for them and get out of the way? It's all a question of choice. Normally we don't think that, but it is. It's a question of choice. And that choice is in our hands, not anybody else's. And we're the only ones who can do it. Okay, so we'll sit for just a second.